HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Brains Through Time, A Natural History of Vertebrates by Georg F. Strider and R. Glenn Northcutt. Read by Tom Perkins. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures and tables included in the print and e-book editions of the book. Preface. For a professor to write a book with one of his Ph.D. students 20 years after said student left the lab is highly unusual. It suggests a complicated backstory. Indeed, the idea for this book was hatched a long, long time ago. Here is what Glenn, the senior author, wrote in 1996 in his initial proposal to publishers. The evolution of vertebrate brains and the behaviors they subserved can best be understood in the broader context of vertebrate evolution. In order to understand why brains exhibit different patterns of organization among existing vertebrates, it is first necessary to understand the origin and subsequent radiation of each vertebrate group. This, in turn, necessitates some understanding of the physical and biological worlds in which these events took place. When vertebrate diversity is viewed in this context, it becomes apparent that the origin of each vertebrate group was based on a few key innovations that allowed an ancestral population to exploit the environment in a novel way. Subsequent evolution of that population was channeled, both facilitated and constrained, by these innovations. Once the key innovations of a particular group are identified, it is possible to see how brains were modified and how they reflected and subserved these innovations. While this approach is widely used in most areas of biological research, neurobiology is a notable exception. Most neurobiological research is model-driven and results in detailed data that are frequently unintelligible and uninteresting to most integrative and organismal biologists. This book is an attempt to bring neurobiology within the purview of the wider integrative biological audience and at the same time to demonstrate the strengths of a comparative approach to the neurobiological community. This proposal was met with great excitement by Glenn's students and friends, and it resulted in a book contract. However, execution of the plan was far more challenging than expected. As Glenn began to write, the number of planned pages swelled, and many pages filled with jargon and a slew of anatomical details. The number of planned figures also grew as Glenn developed plans to illustrate the internal organization of many different vertebrate brains, their cranial nerves, and all the major sense organs, not to mention their phylogenetic relationships and ecological contexts. Long fragments of two chapters gradually emerged, but Glenn became increasingly concerned about losing his audience. Who would want to read this book? Who would be able to absorb all of the included detail? As the concerns grew, the book project languished. When Glenn retired in the summer of 2014, Glenn's friends urged him to pick the project up again. Especially adamant were some of Glenn's former students, among them Georg. Toward the end of 2014, over lunch in San Diego, Georg offered to help in any way he could. Having just finished the writing of an introductory textbook on neurobiology, Georg was also casting about for a new, big project. By the end of lunch, a plan was hatched for Georg to join the project as junior partner, using his book writing skills to complement Glenn's deep knowledge of vertebrate brains, both extant and extinct. Georg's knowledge of avian and mammalian nervous systems would also nicely complement Glenn's expertise on piscine, amphibian, and reptilian brains. As first author, Georg would do the writing and generate most of the figures, but both authors plan to meet regularly to harmonize their vision, hatch specific plans, and discuss revisions to the figures and text. 4 years and more than a dozen face-to-face meetings later, the book is here. Reflecting on the process now, the metaphor of two people paddling a canoe, illustrated in Figure P1, seems apt. Georg was sitting in the front, paddling furiously and alert to diverse obstacles and possible paths. Glenn was in the back, steering in more subtle ways and delivering occasional power strokes. Together they managed to get through unharmed and without major fights. More importantly, they took a path that neither one of them alone would have been able to pursue. Nor was the path entirely predictable. In several cases, both authors abandoned some of their own long-standing views. Those moments were especially thrilling, perhaps because they were risky. 1. Reconstructing History, Aims and Methodology. There is one purpose to life, and one only, to bear witness to and understand as much as possible of the complexity of the world, its beauty, its mysteries, its riddles. The more you understand, the more you look, the greater is your enjoyment of life and your sense of peace. Anne Rice, Servant of the Bones, 1996, page 135. It is interesting to contemplate a tangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent upon each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. There is grandeur in this view of life. Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, 6th edition, 1872, pages 444 to 445. Separated by more than 100 years, by the Atlantic Ocean, and by very different lines of work, Anne Rice and Charles Darwin both described the pleasure that can come from observing nature's complexity. One can, of course, appreciate nature without giving it much thought, but Rice and Darwin were describing a deeper sense of joy, one that comes from not just looking at nature, but from understanding how its diverse elements are connected to one another and to us. This deeper sense of enjoyment lies at the heart of natural history and is what we hope to facilitate. But how does one go from merely looking at nature to understanding it? Two main approaches have been recognized. One is to collect a large number of observations in various places under a variety of different conditions, and then to look for meaningful patterns in the collected data. This comparative approach can suggest hypotheses that might explain the discovered pattern. These hypotheses can then be tested using the second complementary approach, which is to manipulate nature in highly specific ways and then observe whether the manipulations have the expected effects, that is, the experimental method. The crucial difference is that the comparative method relies on naturally occurring variation, whereas the experimental method creates artificial variation that can be tightly controlled. Although the experimental method is often celebrated as the key to scientific success, the comparative approach has played a crucial role in most scientific fields. In the following sections, we illustrate this role first in several non-biological domains and then within biology. Our aim is not to elevate comparative approaches over experimental ones, but to highlight the utility of comparative research, especially in disciplines that are not very amenable to experimentation. This sampling of comparative research in diverse disciplines also allows us to introduce a few concepts that are important for later chapters, such as the idea that a layer of rock can be dated to a specific period in the Earth's history, that continental plates move slowly across the globe, and that the history of species long extinct can be reconstructed from present-day observations. 1.1. Comparative approaches outside of biology. Comparative approaches are used in virtually all fields of academic inquiry, ranging from literature and art to social sciences and economics. For our purposes, it is most instructive to examine how comparative research has advanced our knowledge in some of the physical sciences, notably astrophysics, chemistry, and geology. 1.1.1. Stellar evolution. When you look up at the sky on a clear, moonless night, you may see a few thousand stars. It can be fun and awe-inspiring, especially if you are in the mountains or the desert, but most of us will not see much of a pattern in those stars. You might notice that some are brighter than others, that they vary slightly in color, and that they are more common in some parts of the sky, for instance, the Milky Way. You might even recognize some of the constellations you learned about, but the pattern still appears largely random. Not so for astronomers. Over many years, they diligently collected enormous amounts of data on the position, brightness, luminance, and color of the stars, and then looked for patterns. A major breakthrough came in 1911 to 1913, when Enjar Hertzsprung and Henry N. Russell plotted luminance versus color for hundreds of stars in the same general region of space, which meant that the included stars were likely similar in age and chemical composition. The resulting plot, now called the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, revealed that roughly 90% of all the data points cluster along the diagonal, forming what astronomers call the main sequence, figure 1.1. A second cluster forms a horizontal branch which diverges from the main sequence toward the right side of the diagram. A few additional data points aggregate in the diagram's top right corner, and a few are found near the bottom left. How should one explain this surprisingly heterogeneous, non-random distribution of stars in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram? The answer is that the observed pattern reflects the dynamics of stellar evolution. Astronomers had suspected since the 1880s that stars do not exist for all eternity, but, instead, are born from the contraction of cosmic dust clouds and die when they shrink dramatically and cease to give off light. As a star goes through its life cycle, it changes in brightness and in temperature, that is, color. The importance of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram lay in its implication that stars spend most of their life cycle in an equilibrium state that places them along the main sequence. Combining these data with additional insights from experimental studies and theoretical considerations, astronomers hypothesized that, during their time on the main sequence, stars are burning hydrogen in their core and remain relatively constant in size. When the hydrogen fuel runs out, the stars begin to burn helium in their core. At that point, they move off the main sequence along the horizontal branch or nearby paths and swell until they become giants or, depending on their initial mass, supergiants. Eventually, every star becomes completely depleted of fuel and begins to shrink, collapsing into itself. Such depleted stars then become white dwarfs, or if they had been supergiants, black holes. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram was not, in and of itself, sufficient to generate all this information about stellar evolution, but it was a major factor, for example, in the realization that stars heat up and expand before they cool and shrink. It also influenced Arthur Eddington's theory about what happens inside stars and how this changes over time. Remarkably, these advances in astronomy occurred long before scientists fully understood the chain reactions that happen at the extremely high pressures and temperatures inside a stellar core. That is, they predated our understanding of thermonuclear fusion, which flourished only in the 1940s and 1950s. The new knowledge did force some revision of the original ideas about stellar evolution, but the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is still widely taught and often used to illustrate the developmental trajectories of individual stars. 1.1.2, the periodic table. Chemists labored for many years to identify the 94 different elements of which the natural world is built, as well as a few that can be synthesized. As scientists learned about the characteristics of these elements, they noticed both similarities and differences. Early attempts to make sense of this pattern included the recognition that similar elements sometimes come in groups of three, triads, that elemental properties tend to covary with atomic weight, and that some properties recur at regular intervals, that is, periodically, along a series of increasing atomic weights. The most successful attempt to recognize a meaningful pattern in the available data was that of Mendeleev, who grouped similar elements by arranging them in columns and rows, as shown in Figure 1.2. This effort allowed him to identify some mistakes in the data of the time and, more importantly, to predict the existence of several elements that had not yet been identified. Mendeleev's original periodic table had to be amended in light of subsequent discoveries, such as the identification of noble gases, but his insights were based on a comparative approach and clearly drove the field of chemistry forward. The pattern that Mendeleev identified is not inherently historical, but most chemical elements do have a history. The discovery of this fact owes much to a number of scientists who had collected data on the relative abundance of the various elements. They noticed that hydrogen is by far the most abundant element in the universe, with helium a distant second. All of the other heavier elements are relatively rare. Moreover, plotting an element's abundance against its atomic number revealed a distinct sawtooth pattern, with the even-numbered elements being more abundant than their odd-numbered neighbors, Figure 1.2. Combined with other knowledge, these relative abundance curves suggested that most elements were not generated at the time of the Big Bang, but rather are generated inside stars as they proceed through their life cycle. The fusion of two hydrogen nuclei inside a star generates helium. Subsequently, the fusion of helium nuclei with one another and the fusion of their fusion products in various combinations produces the other elements with even atomic numbers. Fusing some of them with hydrogen atoms creates the odd-numbered elements, but they are less commonly formed and less stable. Hence, the bias toward even-numbered elements, a.k.a. the Otto-Harkins rule. Of course, stellar nucleosynthesis is more complex than we describe, but the comparative approach clearly helped to advance our understanding of how chemical elements are born. We also think that it is beautiful and grand, in Rice's and Darwin's sense, to realize that most of the elements that sustain life on Earth originated in the stars. Since roughly 40 tons of cosmic dust enter our atmosphere each day, and many of its elements end up inside our bodies, we heartily assent to Joni Mitchell's lyrics that we are stardust. 1.1.3 Geological Strata. Gazing at the walls of a steep canyon or a rocky outcrop, it becomes apparent that the Earth's crust forms a series of layers, strata, that differ in their chemical composition. But what does this geological stratification mean? Nicholas Steno, a Catholic priest working for the Medici family in the late 1600s, thought about this problem and realized that the layers were most likely formed by the deposition of new layers on top of older ones, usually as sediment on the bottom of a body of water. He further realized that the layers of rock and soil must have been horizontal when they first formed, but could be tilted or otherwise distorted by subsequent processes. Most importantly, Steno concluded that, at any given location, the upper strata must always be younger than the deeper ones. Steno's insights were extended in the 1790s by William Smith, a British geologist, who noticed that the ordering of the geological strata was consistent from place to place, at least within large parts of England. Being an avid fossil collector, Smith also realized that each layer contained a unique set of fossils, such that he could discriminate geologically similar layers by their fossil content. Combining this insight with Steno's principle of superposition, Smith inferred that the fossils in the upper layers must be younger than those in the lower strata. Similar ideas had been developed independently, convergently, by Georges Cuvier and Alexandre Brongniart in France around the same time. Curiously, none of these authors interpreted the succession of different fossils in the geological strata as evidence of evolution. Cuvier and Brongniart thought the changes were due to local ecological catastrophes, followed by migrations of new species into the formerly devastated areas, and Smith was not very interested in theoretical ideas at all. He was more interested in using his knowledge to find coal deposits or nutrient-rich soil. Indeed, the scientific understanding of geological stratification has frequently helped explorers discover coal, oil, and diverse minerals. As geologists identified more and more geological strata, they grouped adjacent strata into a hierarchical arrangement of stages, series, systems, and erythems. Figure 1.3. Initially, the ages of the various layers could only be determined relative to one another using Steno's principle of superposition. However, the development of carbon dating and various other techniques eventually made it possible to assign specific chronological dates to many of the layer boundaries. As a result, it is now possible to think of individual geological stages, series, systems, and erythems as chronological ages, epochs, periods, and eras, respectively. The Mesozoic era, for example, lasted from 252 to 66 million years ago, and the Jurassic period lasted from 201 to 145 years before the present, figure 1.3. This absolute dating of geological strata is important because it allows us to specify when a particular species first appeared in the fossil record, and if the species became extinct, when it disappeared from that record. Since the fossil record is notoriously incomplete, a species might have existed earlier than the record suggests, and it might well have persisted longer. However, the dated fossils give us minimum estimates for both the first appearance of a species and its longevity. As we discuss shortly, these estimates are very useful for dating the divergence of various groups of animals from one another. 1.1.4 Plate Tectonics. The comparative approach further advanced geology by helping to reveal that the Earth's continents have slowly moved across the globe. One of the first steps in this major discovery was the realization that the western coastline of Africa runs roughly parallel with the eastern coastline of South America. The fit of these continental boundaries is even better when one includes the shallow seas around the continents, that is, the continental shelves, figure 1.4. This fit of the continental boundaries came to the attention of Alfred Wegener, who cleverly combined it with the knowledge that surprisingly similar fossils were found on opposite sides of the Atlantic. In 1912, Wegener proposed that the continents of today had once been assembled into a giant supercontinent, which he called Pangaea. The flip side of this argument was Wegener's continental drift hypothesis, according to which Pangaea broke up when its component continents drifted apart. Unfortunately, the mechanism that Wegener proposed to explain why the continents would move as he proposed was widely deemed implausible and, as a result, his theory was rarely taken seriously. Despite this setback, evidence in favor of continental movements continued to accumulate. Especially important was the discovery that earthquakes and other seismic events were concentrated in specific lines across the globe, figure 1.4, which we now recognize as defining the edges of continental plates. Additional evidence came from paleomagnetic studies, which are based on the fact that the magnetic particles in rocks reflect the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field at the time and place where the rock was formed. Such studies have shown that the ocean floor adjacent to some of the continental plate boundaries exhibits bands of alternating magnetic polarity that run parallel to the plate boundaries. Given that the Earth's magnetic polarity is thought to reverse every few thousand years, these alternating bands suggest that new rock is created at those plate boundaries by molten rock that ascends from deep within the Earth and fills the widening gaps between the continental plates. Additional evidence came from studies that measured the magnetic field in various rock strata on a specific continent, and used these data to estimate the location of the Earth's magnetic poles over millions of years. Such studies showed that the Earth's magnetic poles appear to have moved much more than one would expect from a slight wobbling of the Earth's rotational axis, figure 1.4. The simplest explanation for this observation is that it is not, in fact, the poles that wandered, but the continents. Geologists later combined these diverse forms of evidence with a more plausible mechanism for continental movements, namely a set of convection currents beneath the Earth's crust that can force the continents apart or crash them into one another. These efforts resulted in the theory of plate tectonics, which is now widely accepted. Importantly, for our purposes, geologists can use the apparent polar wander paths as well as other forms of evidence to estimate the location of the various continental plates during the various periods of the Earth's history. The estimates get more uncertain the further back one goes. But for the period during which vertebrates emerged and thrived, that is, after the Cambrian, those estimates are reasonably robust. They indicate, for example, that Pangaea was assembled roughly 335 million years ago and started to break apart 160 million years later. 1.2. The comparative method in biology. Comparative approaches have contributed substantially to many different areas of biology. For example, Alexander von Humboldt at the beginning of the 19th century collected vast amounts of information on the geographical distribution of plants and animals, which eventually led him to realize that particular types of species occur in predictable combinations across the globe. With this insight, he invented the concept of ecological zones and, one might say, ecology in general. Other biologists were preoccupied with arranging the multitude of plant and animal species according to some kind of logical framework. First came the notion of arranging species along a linear scale, but Darwin and others later argued that the underlying pattern was actually a huge family tree. Subsequent generations of biologists focused on how one might reconstruct this tree of life. They also wanted to know how best to trace the evolution of individual traits and how to test hypotheses about adaptation and constraint. In the following, we discuss all these subjects in turn. 1.2.1. Scale of Nature versus Family Tree. Starting at least with Aristotle, scientists have tried to order the different types of animals and plants along a linear scale called Scala Naturae, Latin for scale of nature. The metric for this scale is usually the similarity between a given species and Homo sapiens, such that the animals most similar to us are placed on the highest rungs, while species progressively more different from us are assigned to successively lower positions along the scale. A major problem with this view is that similarity to humans is a highly multidimensional measure, and different dimensions yield different species rankings. For example, rankings based on presumed intelligence might place dolphins high on the scale, while rankings based on mode of locomotion elevate the flightless birds, for instance, kiwis and ostriches, far above dolphins and other aquatic mammals. Regardless of the measure used, adherents of the Scala Naturae view tend to equate increases in similarity to humans with evolutionary progress. Biologists in the second half of the 19th century sought alternative ways to make sense of species similarities and differences. The most successful effort was that of Charles Darwin, who realized in the mid-1800s that the connections between species formed not a scale, but a family tree, a genealogy. In the only figure in his Origin of Species, Darwin illustrated how two species can diverge over the course of many, many generations into multiple distinct populations and eventually into several new species. Figure 1.5. This schema is clearly incompatible with the concept of Scala Naturae. After all, could you rank your own extended family members along a simple linear scale? Therefore, Darwin described the genealogy of species not as a scale, but as a tree of life. In one of his notebooks, he even called it a coral of life, because, as in healthy corals, only the tips are currently alive. Although Darwin remained conflicted about the relationship between evolution and progress, he was quite clear that any such progress could be reversed, and in any case, evolution did not follow a single linear path. Although Darwin's ideas became widely accepted, Scala Naturae thinking remains widespread. Even expert neurobiologists often resurrect it in the form of a phylogenetic scale. For example, they often draw phylogenetic trees that look like conifers, that is, fir trees, with humans perched on top and all the lower branches neatly pruned. Other diagrams may look more deeply branched, that is, bush-like, but all the living species are arranged in series from low to high with humans at the top, figure 1.6. As further evidence that the
sample complete. Ready to continue?